My guest today is Dar Jamal, American journalist who Unembedded has been living and reporting from Iraq off and on since November 2003. His reports have contradicted the mainstream U.S. press accounts of the situation in Iraq, have been indispensable reading for those wishing to understand the continuing U.S. occupation. His columns and near-daily blogs can be found on his website, www.darjamail.com, antiwar.com, IPS News Service. Let's see if we have Dar on the phone. Hello, Dar, can you hear me?
Hi, John.
You have been covering the Iraq War since November 2003. You've been bringing back reports that have eluded the mainstream media. In the last week, we have seen, or at least believe we have seen, the killing of Zarqawi, and yesterday the latest mission accomplishment stunt on the part of President Bush. But as you have mentioned in your message to me, something bigger is going on there around the city of Ramadi, which the mainstream media seems to be ignoring. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, the situation in Ramadi is very disconcerting because it's a very large military operation that is in progress as we speak, and also disconcerting because it's basically a media blackout. They're not even allowing embedded reporters with this one, unlike even Fallujah, which was a total massacre of between 4,000 and 6,000 people. A little bit about Ramadi first. It is the capital city of Al-Anbar province. It is larger than Fallujah. Geographically, it's twice as big, and there are more residents. There's over 400,000 people who live there. And the U.S., it's such a big area. The U.S. hasn't been able to totally surround the city like they did Fallujah. Instead, they've sealed both of the main bridges in and out of the city. And then now they're going neighborhood by neighborhood with ground troops and helicopters and attacking fighters where they find them. This is causing, it's generating a very large number of people who are leaving the country, the city, into the other parts of the country. There's been approximately 3,000 families who have left now, so approximately 24,000 people, according to an Italian NGO, the Italian Consortium of Solidarity, based in Amman, who uses people in Ramadi to try to get relief goods in there to help people. And but of course, once again, like the Fallujah siege, there hasn't been any tents or relief supplies provided by the U.S. military. So people, about 30% of those who have left, have actually gone to Fallujah, who's still recovering from their siege. Many have gone to Baghdad, and then the rest are, according to the emergency director at the Italian NGO, he said that people are, the rest of them are basically wandering around Al-Anbar province looking for some place to stay.
Now, it's interesting. I remember there were reports in the press that many of the fighters who had escaped from Fallujah had then taken up their positions in Ramadi, and this was going to be the excuse. They talked about Ramadi, an assault in Ramadi, a while back, and then there was a report, of course, that 3,500 reservists based in Kuwait were being moved to take part in fighting in Anbar province, and that's the last thing we heard about it.
Well, that's right. It's essentially those 1,500 troops that were brought in from Kuwait were sent straight to Ramadi. So these are people that have had basically no combat experience, and they're being sent right into the largest ongoing military operation in Iraq in a very, very volatile city. Another important thing that people should know about Ramadi is that all of Iraq is extremely tribal, but especially Al-Anbar. So Ramadi is very close to Fallujah. It's basically a 15-minute car ride from Fallujah, and it's so many of the same tribe live in both cities that people in Ramadi actually call Fallujah Ramadi. There are so many people in Ramadi who had relatives killed in Fallujah, just as you alluded to. So certainly the city is overall very anti-occupation, very anti-American, and are willing to fight to kick the occupation forces out of their city. But the problem is that, once again, now there's not that big of a number of fighters in the city, and so instead the U.S. is being forced to, if they're wanting to try to control the situation, to go neighborhood by neighborhood to try to clear areas. But we can already look at Fallujah for where this is probably going to go, where even to this day the U.S. doesn't control large areas of Fallujah.
And we also never got a report of what was done in Fallujah, which is interesting. The attacks on Fallujah, the first attack in November of 2003, I believe, was remarkably similar to the excuse for it, to what Saddam Hussein and the Iraqi officials under him are being accused of revenge against the Shia who tried to assassinate him. And that attack in the Fallujah, the first attack, was apparently in response to revenge for killing these four contractors.
That's a very good point, right. It's another instance of the U.S. being very, very hypocritical and basically following in the footsteps of things that Saddam Hussein did, whether it's revenge attacks or whether it's torturing people in Abu Ghraib or occupying even his very own palaces and his own military sites to place U.S. military. So this has been rampant across Iraq, and this is a big reason why I remember early on in the occupation, so many Iraqis in Baghdad were saying, the student is gone, the master has arrived, of course, referencing the U.S., who essentially, through a CIA coup, helped Saddam come to power to begin with, but now they had taken their student out of the way and decided to run things in Iraq themselves.
It's interesting, despite the talks of Iraqi sovereignty, BBC pointed out on Saturday that the insult to Iraq's so-called sovereignty about Bush's surprise visit, in which al-Maliki didn't find out about it until 5 minutes before Bush showed up. And evidently, according to the newspaper reports, even the New York Times, a great cover-up publication, reported that he was very quiet, relatively quiet, during Bush's presentation and afterward. The message, NPR finally did mention this morning that there was, it was kind of a blow to a sovereign country to have a president from another country show up unexpected. I don't think this surprises the people of Iraq very much, however. What do you think?
It really doesn't, and Maliki, while it does further undermine his credibility, and it's not surprising to see that he would be very disturbed by Mr. Bush basically sitting in the green zone and then getting word, oh yes, by the way, Mr. Bush is going to be showing up in 5 minutes, please smile when you get in front of the cameras, because this is an individual whose credibility was already extremely undermined before he even took power, because he didn't take control of the government, replacing former Prime Minister Jaffery, until Condoleezza Rice and Jack Straw from London made a surprise visit to Baghdad and basically edged Jaffery out of the picture and made way for Maliki to come in, because he was a little bit more of a yes man. But ironically, so his credibility already tainted before he even took the reins. Now with Mr. Bush showing up, it certainly tanks whatever credibility he may have had left. And I think this is evidenced by what we just see on the ground, that this is a government, not just Maliki, but the entire Iraqi parliament, that has no credibility with the Iraqi people to begin with, because people are saying things in Baghdad. What good is this government if they can't even get us an extra hour of electricity per day because we only have 3 hours of electricity per day? Or what good is this government if they can't even provide us security in the capital city? So already with flailing credibility, basically the last thing Maliki needed was a visit from the most hated man in Iraq, which would be Mr. Bush.
Probably in the world.
I think that's safe to say.
Now today the reports that al-Maliki may be pushed on by the resident of the White House has put checkpoints all over Baghdad, which is totally tied up, the traffic such as it is, and it probably was fairly tied up even before that, that people cannot move around, but there are checkpoints everywhere.
Well, you're exactly right. That's actually, and they've done this sort of a security clampdown in Baghdad before, although this one is with far more troops. And that's a very important point, that Baghdad, so many people won't leave their homes simply because it does take them hours and hours to get across just one part of the city. There's been an explosion of new cars there after the invasion occurred. And then now that, coupled with a horrific gas crisis with gas lines clogging the streets, and then add in 75,000 troops and loads of new checkpoints and ongoing military operations in the capital city, one can only imagine what that looks like. This is a capital city of 6 million people, completely clogged streets, violence and chaos everywhere. So without a doubt, it's certainly not going to do anything to help the credibility. And it is if you look at the timing of all this, it's quite interesting, and I'm sure it's not a coincidence that yesterday Bush does his token six-hour visit to Baghdad. The next day, they launch this operation, which is called Operation Forward Together. I guess that's supposed to be a ringy propaganda title for American and Iraqi security forces working together in Baghdad. And then also yesterday in Afghanistan, they launched the largest military operation there involving 11,000 soldiers since the fall of the Taliban.
It doesn't look like the U.S. is winning this war, this endless war. There doesn't seem to be, you know, any way out. These photo ops, as we had yesterday, how many can they produce? One thing, what's happened with, and I'm going to talk about Zarqawi in a moment, but the killing or apparent killing of Zarqawi and Bush's trip there has succeeded in taking Haditha off the headlines, often out of the newspapers entirely, as well as the mention that had been of other massacres by U.S. soldiers that had been reported. Is there a coincidence? Is it just that this happened by accident?
Well, there is a lot of speculation about when was Zarqawi actually killed, but I haven't seen anything really solid enough yet that would truly show that he was killed actually before when he actually was, but nevertheless, I think that it is important to note the timing, and I think it's certainly no coincidence whatsoever that they would have this attack right at this time. I've really likened this killing of Zarqawi to take media attention away from Haditha, to the Nick Berg beheading in relation to Abu Ghraib. If you look back during Abu Ghraib, we had these photos coming out, more and more photos coming out, more and more information coming out of not just Abu Ghraib, but other prisons about U.S. Torture and atrocities being carried out there. And as that was peaking, we had this horrific video released of a supposed beheading of Nick Berg by Zarqawi. And I say supposed because obviously it was a beheading, but whether it was Zarqawi or not actually doing that is certainly in question. And then that basically took all media question directly away from Abu Ghraib very, very effectively. And then flash forward to Haditha, the media attention, more and more atrocities are coming out, more soldiers are stepping out and making comments of what they'd seen during the aftermath and this sort of thing. And then all of a sudden this Haditha, this killing of Zarqawi, takes all the Haditha attention out of the press, and now all we've been hearing about is Zarqawi and how security is improving is now the news coming out today from Mr. Bush's White House. And the reality is, really, it's just a huge propaganda stunt, because I think we should get used to this, because the Bush administration now, they don't have any more elections in Iraq that they can call turning points or tipping points. No more of these kind of U.S. arbitrarily set dates of transfers of sovereignty or constitutional referendums. So instead, now they have to generate their own propaganda with things like killing Zarqawi. Now they already have a new supposed bad guy who stepped into his shoes to be a new leader in Iraq. So now they can basically continue to chase the bad guy in Iraq and then somewhere down the road kill him and have another show. I think it's all very, very carefully stage managed, as all of the propaganda surrounding Iraq that has come out of the Bush administration from the very beginning.
Well, it does seem, according to the administration's own reports, the reports you get from the press, about how they've been following Zarqawi and following a sheikh who's connected to him, it would indicate that they might have had other opportunities over the past weeks to actually go in and take him out. It was also curious, there was no attempt to capture him, but to kill him, and you would think, well, to capture him, get information and so on, but the attempt was made to assassinate him, and they obviously had the place surrounded, so it's quite clear he was very useful to them as a propaganda focus, but maybe they decided now we have, this is the time to get rid of him, and they could have done it any time over a number of weeks.
Well, I think that's a very important point, actually, because we have a situation where if this individual was truly what the Bush administration made him out to be, if he was truly the leader of the resistance, which is absolute hogwash, but let's just suppose he was, and if he had all of this information about attacks and ongoing resistance operations and this sort of thing, he would have been the most important intelligence source they could have captured. And if they knew specifically enough where he was and which house at which time, why didn't they roll in there and get him and detain him and try to get information out of him? Instead, they just kill him. It makes absolutely no logistical sense. Anyone with half of a brain running an operation like the U.S. is running in Iraq to try to stop a growing resistance, if you had a chance to get the man that was supposedly the leader, wouldn't you take it? So, again, killing him makes no logistical sense whatsoever, other than it'd be a nice, big, fat propaganda ploy.
Now, what was also curious is I read a lot, as much as I could stomach, about the capture of Zarqawi, because I was looking, or not the capture, the killing, but I was looking for some analyst to raise the question of why they hadn't tried to capture him. And that this didn't come up was actually startling, because it seems to be an obvious question. And maybe this is one of the things I say, don't ask that question. It's somehow Zarqawi's emergence as the number one dartboard target created by the government and the media reminds me very much of the 60s, in which the media created many so-called leaders of the American anti-war movement. And they hadn't done it themselves, but by the media picking certain people out, those people then became the so-called leaders of the movement, not comparing the individuals in terms of what they did, but the way the media and the government is able to manipulate the image of the opposition. It hasn't changed much, except perhaps more sophisticated now than before.
I think that's right, and I think, you know, it's another important element along those lines when we're talking about Zarqawi and these ongoing attempts of the Bush administration and U.S. military in Iraq to paint a foreign face onto the resistance, because it's simply very, very bad PR for them to have to admit in the international media that actually, even according to the U.S. military, at least 94% of the people they're fighting in Iraq are the Iraqi people. That even according to the military, the maximum 6% of the people in Iraq launching attacks against them are from outside the country. And we've even had documented evidence by the U.S. military showing that Iraqi resistance groups are actually actively fighting people coming in from outside the country, because just like they don't want U.S. Foreign troops in their country, they don't want foreign fighters from other countries inside of Iraq either. So that's an important thing to note. So as a result, we have a situation where the U.S. is constantly trying to attempt to portray the Iraqi resistance as terrorists, as al-Qaeda, as people like Zarqawi who are not Iraqis, because the reality is it looks really bad. The fact that we have a massive and growing resistance now in Iraq, comprised the vast majority of which is comprised of Iraqis who the U.S. supposedly liberated.
Now, the other conflict there has become very troubling. Obviously, the Shia saw the U.S. invasion as a vehicle to get power that had been denied them under Saddam. And it would seem that Sunnis, although Sunni and Shia intermarried and lived together in Iraq, that particularly foreign Sunnis, as well as some Iraqi Sunnis, might accept the idea of a Shia-governed Iran or dominated Iran, because the Iranians are not, after all, Arab. But the idea that the Shia would govern Mesopotamia, the ancient heart of the Middle East, is something that some Sunnis simply can't abide by, and so we've had this sectarian killing, and then of course then the revenge on the part of Shia militias, which have alliance. How close is this to a civil war?
Well, I've been saying for a good while now that it has been an ongoing slow burn civil war. The Bush administration likes to avoid calling it a civil war, because that is the excuse they're now using to stay in Iraq. They use the excuse, well, if the U.S. pulls out, Iraq will immediately plunge into sectarian civil war. And the reality is we've had an ongoing sort of low-burn civil war for quite some time, because if we look back to when Negroponte was the U.S. ambassador sitting in Baghdad, That was back in January 05 when Secretary of Defense Rumsfeld talked about the quote-unquote Salvador option. So, of course, as I'm sure you all know, Jeff, that if we look back to who was the Secretary of State to Honduras in the Reagan administration when the death squads were instituted, well, once again, we had John Negroponte. Well, once again, he was the ambassador when the death squads really started to get their legs under them. And even before Secretary of Defense Rumsfeld made those remarks about the Salvador option, we were already getting countless reports coming out of places around Baghdad of death squads going around and carrying out assassinations. And now we have a situation where, primarily due to the death squads, we have massive sectarian infighting and really a low-burn civil war that everyone is hoping doesn't continue to grow. But because of these death squads, it is continuing to grow, and the very real possibility of a all-out civil war grows along with that.
It's interesting that we have the two major parties, Iranian parties or Shia parties, that were actually initiated in Iran, the Skiri and the Dawa, and that probably the only thing that might unite the Shia and the Sunnis would be a U.S. attack on Iran, which obviously would cause the Shia to turn their weapons on U.S. soldiers in Iraq, and probably one of the reasons I don't believe that there's going to be an attack on Iran.
If there is that attack, I think you're exactly right. We would see immediately the Shia, primarily the Badr Corps and others who are composing the death squads right now, would immediately turn their guns on the U.S. soldiers who right now are paying their wages and giving them training and backup support. And I think that it would be an absolute disaster for the U.S. to go on and attack Iran. I guess I would differ a little bit from you. I think that these people in charge of the White House are lunatics, and we start to make a mistake when we try to impose logic and common sense as to their planning. And I certainly don't hope that they attack Iran. In fact, I would abhor the idea, but I certainly at this point, I think they're capable of anything, and that possibility can't be ruled out, which would, of course, turn Iraq into a situation that would be so horrible that we would be hoping that it was as good as it is right now, which is a total disaster.
Well, I've been saying if the U.S. would attack Iran, which what is in Iraq now would be looked back as a garden party.
I would agree with that.
Yeah, I was thinking there was, I reported today in Sidney Blumenthal, report on Salon.com, that Senior Bush was trying to get Rumsfeld out and get a general in, because it's obvious that there are people seeing in the White House and around in Washington who see that this current administration as a threat to the capitalist system. And we actually can go to our phones now. I think we have a first caller. Hello, you're on the air.
Yeah, I would like to compliment your guest on his courage and his truthfulness. My question is that given that the people of Iraq consider the government a sham, but the Bush administration has use for the sham in order to play it to the American people after the election, does Dar Jamal think that once again the United States military will assert itself and establish permanent bases in Iraq?
That's a good question, because I was going to ask you about is there a possibility of peace and end into the resistance of war if U.S. bases remain there?
Without a doubt, and it is a very good question, an important question, and also for your words. And I think it's important to talk about these bases, because I think if we look at the fact that the U.S. so-called embassy there, this is an embassy unlike any embassy ever built on the planet, that is 21 buildings for 8,000 employees. When it's completed, it's going to be two-thirds the size of the National Mall in Washington, D.C. It has things like a first-run movie theater, the largest swimming pool in the country, a vehicle maintenance garage, a school for children of the people working there. So this is the so-called embassy that's being built as right on time in the green zone in Baghdad. And if we talk about the bases, we're talking about between at the minimum of 6 and a maximum of 14 permanent U.S. military bases there. One of these bases, for example, is called Camp Anaconda, which is in Balad. It's also an air base, and that's just outside of Baghdad, a little bit north-northeast of Baghdad. This is a base for 20,000 soldiers, where they're already there, less than 1,000 of whom ever even leave the base. It, too, has a first-run movie theater, concrete troop barracks where they're running internet lines and overseas phone lines and cable television lines. There is a Subway sandwich shop, a 24-hour Burger King, things like Popeye's Fried Chicken, things like Starbucks coffee shops and this sort of thing. So just to give you an idea, this is the kind of base that is being built in Iraq. They're absolutely massive. Some of them are big enough that soldiers even participate in their own Ironman triathlons where they're running marathons, riding their bikes 140 miles. So just to give you an idea, these are the bases that are in Iraq, and without a doubt they're permanent, and Iraqis are all too aware of that fact.
Thanks very much. We'll go to the caller. Hello, you're on the air.
Before you referred to the contractors in Fallujah where they were actually Blackwater mercenaries, is there more information about what these contractors, and particularly the special forces and irregular warfare that the military talks about are doing there? Any signs of like an Operation Phoenix type operation? And
it was a good question. Thank you for that.
Yeah, and thanks for clarifying that. I do prefer to refer to them as mercenaries, since that is more a more accurate description of what they are. But these hired guns in Iraq, there are a minimum of 20,000 of these mercenaries. These are people that basically the Bush administration, in order to avoid a draft, which would be political suicide, is compensating for a lack of soldiers in Iraq by paying and bringing in these mercenaries who are from countries all around the globe, not just from the U.S. They're being paid between $500 and $1,500 every single day. And since they are private companies, it's difficult to find exactly the number of mercenaries that are there. We know the minimum is 20,000, but there could be as many as 70,000 actually actively operating inside of Iraq. And they are being used to carry out really a lot of the dirty work of the U.S. military, as the caller mentioned. They are being used to do things like carry out assassinations. They are being used in some of to do some of the torturing that's happening in the military detention facilities. They don't have to operate under the military code of warfare, so they can do things like use different types of ammunition that the military uses, and certainly use different techniques than the U.S. military does. And these individuals that were, the four of them for Blackwater USA, who were killed on March 31st, 2004, which really sparked the siege, were killed for a couple of different reasons. One was out of rage, because these types of mercenaries were going around in Fallujah and carrying out very nasty operations like the caller alluded to, but also that was a response for the assassination of Sheikh Yassin, the Hamas leader in Gaza, on March 22nd by the Israeli military. Of course, an American helicopter, an American-made rocket is what killed him. So that was also a reprisal attack for the assassination of Sheikh Yassin.
It's interesting. You make the connection between the U.S. war in Iraq and the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, which is something the media and certain segments of the anti-war movement do everything to avoid making that comparison, and it's a very important one, because we might even comment on the assistance that the Israeli military has given to the U.S. in terms of dealing with Arab occupation of an Arab land.
Well, it's extremely important, and it can't be discounted, despite the fact that there's basically a corporate media blackout on the fact that the U.S. And Israeli relations, especially militarily, are already having blowback in Iraq, like the situation we just talked about regarding Fallujah. But even just very recently, another $2.8 billion was allocated to Israeli military and government aid. Israel continues to be the biggest recipient of foreign aid the U.S. gives to anyone, and you look at how small the country is and how many people are there, I think that says a lot in itself. And the bottom line is that, especially when you're in Iraq, and most people there get their news from outlets like Al Jazeera and Al Arabiya, not Al Arakiya. And what they're seeing is things like what recently happened in Gaza of Palestinian civilians being killed by the Israeli military. And then they see those same types of tanks and those same types of helicopters being used now in Iraq, and the same types of tactics as far as home demolitions, collective punishments, and needless to say, people are enraged. And it's another thing that's really fueling the Iraqi resistance, because people see very clearly, well, we can look at what's happening in Palestine and flash forward 40, 50 years down the road. Do we want to have Iraq look like that? Well, if not, we better fight it right now. And since most other nonviolent means have been made unavailable by the U.S. military and by this puppet government, more and more people are choosing to pick up arms.
It's interesting. One of the arguments that I've made about Israel wanting the U.S. to invade Iraq and also be a fellow occupier of an Arab land was that the United States would be then less prone to criticize Israel, even pay lip service to Israel's ongoing human rights violations in occupied territories. And the response of the U.S. To the Israeli shelling and killing of a family in Gaza on Friday, which was by a former U.S. military officer now working with Human Rights Watch, saying it was an Israeli shell, 155-millimeter shell. Scott McCormick, a White House spokesman, a State Department spokesman, said the Israelis have to defend themselves. So the U.S. criticism of Israel's human rights violation has really gone down, even though it was lip service before, since the U.S. is doing the same thing in Iraq.
Well, right, without a doubt. And when we see this type of propaganda that, well, you know, Israel must defend itself by shelling a beach full of Palestinian civilians, trying to have a little respite from their daily living situation. It's kind of the same type of propaganda that we see that, well, an aggressive invasion of a country like Iraq that has never been a threat to the United States other than having a bunch of oil under its soil, that is for national security. So it's rather amazing to see this type of propaganda being used up by both sides, but then again, not surprising. But the bottom line is, this is a very this relationship between the U.S. and Israeli governments, and particularly their militaries, is their policy is not providing more security for the people of Israel or the people in the United States. In fact, it's very clear now to see that with ongoing unconditional support of Israel and their aggression against what's going on in the occupied territories, coupled with U.S. aggressive wars in both Afghanistan and Iraq and possibly more to come, that's the reason why U.S. credibility is now shot and why more people now in the world consider the United States a graver threat than something like Iran possibly obtaining a nuclear weapon.
Well, actually, polls have been taken, and the U.S. leads in Europe and the world. Polls have been taken. How legit they are, I don't know, but Israel is, the U.S. is considered the major threat, and Iran is a single digit. And it's interesting that the countries the neighbors of Iran are less worried about Iran getting nuclear weapons than is the United States, supposedly. And of course, the fact that Israel has nuclear weapons is never even mentioned, never discussed, and yet everyone knows that. It's interesting, some years ago, and actually in 1982, I had a chance to speak with Prime Minister Olmert, who came to San Francisco to debate the Lebanon War with someone from Peace Now. It wasn't much of a debate. They both agreed, more than disagreed. But afterward, actually, my sister asked him about Israel's nuclear weapons, and Olmert said, listen, we have missiles that could target Moscow, but doesn't mean we're going to use them. And then he repeated that again. And that was 1982. They had missiles targeting Moscow. It may be that the world is terrorized both by the United States and by Israel.
I think that's true, and I think, you know, again, that it's very interesting to note what you said about the fact that all of the Iran's neighbors don't feel that it's a threat, and yet the U.S. is turning it into the next big evil country that might need to be invaded, or at least. And the same exact thing could have been said about Iraq, where, aside from Israel aside, none of Iraq's neighbors felt that Saddam Hussein was a threat. He was being very effectively contained by the sanctions and UN weapons inspectors, which had already proved that there was no threat in that country to the U.S. or even its neighbors. Yet the aggressive war was carried out anyway.
Well, Dara, I want to thank you. We're coming toward the end of the hour. I want to give people a way to get information about you and your writings. So I know I mentioned earlier the website of darjamailiraq.com, darjamail, iraq.com, is that correct?
That is, thanks.
And antiwar.com, or is that antiwar.org?
Truthout.org, those are places that are most commonly publishing my writings these days.
And you have an almost daily blog?
Well, it's daily when I'm over in the Middle East,
right?
Because there's so much. But over here, every week I'm adding one or two articles to it.
Are you planning another trip back there? I know it's pretty hazardous for journalists these days. The most hazardous place, actually, any war zone ever, I guess.
That's right. I do plan to go back to the Middle East quite soon, actually, but not back to Iraq for now.
I can understand that. Well, listen, I want to thank you very much for being our guest on Takes on the World today. Keep going with your great work and your great writings and bringing this information to us. And we look forward to hearing you next time on Democracy Now! As well as in this program.
Thanks very much, Jeff.
Take care.
You too.